You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 26, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
On this date in 1676, Antoine van Leeuwenhoek, I hope I'm not botching that too badly, applied his hobby of making microscopes from his own handmade lenses to observe water running off a roof during a heavy rainstorm. Now follow me here. He found out that it contained, in his words, very little animalcules. You ever heard
that
term before?
I love that term, animalcules. Yes.
I think my daughter used to say that at like 3 years old or so.
I think Jay still says that.
I wrote a book with that name in the title.
You wrote a book?
Yeah.
It was a little kid. It was really cute. A little kid's picture book with pictures
with my daughter,
of his daughter,
Julia. Julia and the animalcules.
This was a fundamental discovery. It showed that bacteria and one-celled animals did not just fall from the sky. And
what a coincidence.
He used these droplets as microscope lenses that these droplets were. Okay, so here's what he did. He took a ball of molten glass that gets inflated like a balloon, right? And there were these small droplets that formed the very bottom of the bubble. Well, he took those, I guess after they hardened, and used those to view the animalcules in the water. And, you know, it was one of the first discoveries into microscopic life. So that was interesting.
Talk about one of the most fundamental discoveries. Imagine, how do you sleep that night when you see something like that? Like, holy crap.
I know, I'd love to see him at the moment of discovery when he realized that, you know, these were super tiny creatures, you know?
There is a microscopic world living among us.
I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. Like that first time I found out that there's a bunch of little tiny parasites living in your eyebrows.
I hate that. Don't you just totally hate that?
Good night, everybody.
Yeah.
But Evan, once again, you missed something by one day. So what was May 25th?
May 25th, 2008 is when the Phoenix lander landed on Mars.
Now, even more important than that. More important than that.
I was going to say we could get to that later.
Wasn't it the last landing of Atlantis?
That's today. Not tomorrow.
Oh, that was today. Okay.
Yeah, that's
yeah
today.
That was today, the 26th. No, May 25th is Towel Day.
Oh.
Are you telling me you guys didn't
How could
walk
you
around with
towel
towels?
No, but I did know where my towel was, though.
Okay.
That's more important, but wow.
I thought it was Trowel Day. I've been walking around with this thing in my hand, and I'm ready to dig something. I'm embarrassed now.
So, of course, this is a whimsical way to celebrate the life and work of Douglas Adams, author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Woo-hoo. And some of the characters in those novels would walk around everywhere with towels. So, of course, these were super towels that did all sorts of things. They weren't just really absorbent.
Right, just nutrients soaked in one corner.
Yeah.
Little tools, I think, too.
You could live off a thing in the desert if you had to.
They weren't that different.
No. Not incredibly different. Still, it's just like super towels.
I don't really remember them as being super towels. It was just, you know, you could wear it on your head in the desert, and all the description of it is just normal.
All the things you could do with an actual towel.
That whole towel thing definitely sticks with everyone who reads the book.
Yeah.
You know, people walk away with the towel thing, you know?
We have an interview coming up with James Randi later in the show to remember Martin Gardner, who passed away this week. We'll have a long conversation with Randi about him. Of course, he knew him very well. But first, we're going to do some news items. Bob, you're going to tell us about the batteries that ran, quote-unquote batteries, that provided energy for the earliest life on Earth.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting. Researchers at the University of Leeds in the UK, they think they might have uncovered the energy source for the first life forms that existed on Earth. And of course, all the news outlets now are saying, you know, they've got all these articles about nature's batteries and stuff. But this time period, it involves a critical time on Earth when life was just, you know, just barely getting a foothold. It's closely related to abiogenesis, which is the development of life from non-life. Or to put it another way, the transition on Earth from chemistry to biology, which is the way I like to put it. There's lots of different theories about abiogenesis, and Steve, I'm sure you're familiar with a few of them.
Right.
But they really all have to deal with two key components, replication and metabolism. Now, some scientists think that metabolism came first, But from what I can gather, it seems nowadays some of the more modern theories are kind of thinking that perhaps replication came first before metabolism did. But intertwined with these two components, though, is another critical factor, and that factor is energy. But this is kind of a problem, though, because much of biology today uses an energy source that the earliest life forms probably did not use. I'm talking about one of the most important molecules for life on the planet. It's ATP, otherwise known as adenosine triphosphate. This is basically the energy currency of cells in all animals, essentially. It stores and transports energy within cells to do, you know, to do little things like making proteins and contracting muscles, you know, little things like that. But right now you have about, the average person has 250 grams of ATP in your body, which is roughly equivalent, this was surprising to me, this is roughly equivalent to a AA battery.
Wait, Bob.
Yeah.
From what you just said, that makes me think that that is all the energy that we have stored in our body right now that we could use, and that's not a lot of power.
No, but the thing is, you have roughly 250 grams of ATP in your body, but in the course of a day, Jay, you create and consume your body weight in ATP. So put it that way.
So you have a AA battery basically in your body, but you go through one every how many seconds?
You know, if you make and consume your body weight in ATP every day, I did a little calculation to find out how many AA batteries a person would use up in a day just going about normal activities. So a 200-pound man would need 363 AA batteries every day just to live. Imagine replacing those every day. So that was an interesting little – that was a fun little thing, assuming that that calculation is correct.
But Bob, you know what I'm about to ask, okay? And I'm sure that there's other people out there that are – they're smart enough to get it, and I'm dumb enough to not get it.
Right.
How can I create my own body weight in ATP and then have it be destroyed every day of my life? Was there an enormous amount of like recycling of that matter?
There is.
Yes.
There is. It's because of the nature of the shape of the ATP molecule. Because basically what you're doing is you're popping off a phosphate group off of the tip of the ATP molecule to release the energy. So now you've got ADP, adenosine diphosphate. So that's got two phosphate groups. So then all you got to do is throw on one more phosphate group. Bam, you got your ATP again. So that's kind of how it's working. So it's not like you're taking matter, creating energy from it.
Yeah, you're just cycling back and forth between ADP and ATP.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah,
all right.
That's all.
So,
yeah.
So would you guys consider this to be like an efficient way to store energy?
It's a lot of energy to store in a chemical bond. So given that we're biochemical creatures that have to live on chemical energy, it's one of the best ones out there. Yeah.
Yeah. And
I'm trying to gauge this against, like, say, a real battery, and which would be more efficient at storing energy and accessing that energy.
Well, think about the Matrix. I mean, the computers obviously thought that humans made a better battery than batteries. So
mm-hmm. That's right. You're right.
Well, don't get me started on that.
But to put this back into context.
Oh, sorry.
What we're talking about here is the transition from chemical evolution to biological evolution. How did we get that leg up from just the chemical soup to biology? And this is one of the steps that we're missing. How did
cells get their energy? This is where I'm driving, Steve, because
I know ATP, I'm trying to get you there. Go.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Take the rudder.
That's why ATP is a bit of a problem, because you need ATP to make enzymes. But you also need enzymes to use the ATP. So how do you, you know, how does,
oh boy.
How did biology...
Are you saying that it's irreducibly complex?
Whoa.
Yep. Well, so, Bob, you're an idiot.
Oh, God. Yeah, so cut me off halfway through and call me an idiot. So
but?
The main question is, how did biology use energy then before these two things even existed?
Well, which one came first then?
Halfway.
This is the – it doesn't really matter. This is the crux of this new discovery made by these scientists. I'm finally getting to what this discovery is. They realized that there's a molecule out there called pyrophosphite that could fit the bill. Pyrophosphate is similar to ATP, but it could potentially transfer energy without using enzymes. So that's their major discovery, is that this pyrophosphite helped ease us into this transition into ATP. So if you put it all together, this is kind of how I see it. You know, we're not sure where phosphorus even came from in our atmosphere. So the main theory now people are throwing around is that probably meteorites brought phosphorus to the young Earth. And then because the early Earth was acidic and volcanic, it actually turned phosphorus into pyrophosphate, which may have supplied the constant energy that this new life needed, you know, when basic chemistry was transitioning to complex biology. So perhaps then, you know, ATP and the enzyme partnership that it has evolved over time, which then completely took over for the pyrophosphate. So that's kind of where they're going, I think, with the theory that it was a transitional energy source.
It's a stepping stone. Yeah.
Right.
Bob, are you saying that this all happened by accident?
Yeah, what are the odds of that happening all at once?
Yeah.
So, guys, do you think that ATP was basically one of, like, the absolute first things that could have, you know, been, like, the push for things to actually be able to – for biology to come
into so being? Universal that I'm sure it's something that was developed really early on.
Yes, and spread like wildfire because I guess, you have to assume that ATP, you know, as good as pyrophosphate might have been – ATP, for some reason, which wasn't clear to me in what I read, ATP is superior.
I think it's just a really convenient molecule. And it's not necessarily the only energy-carrying molecule that life could have used. It's just the one that happened to occur.
It's the one that survived.
And it works well enough that it would have had an advantage over a lot of other ones.
Right, well, that's my point. It was better than pyrophosphate.
Yeah. Are they saying that ATP just happened to have come into existence just by these... you know, molecules connecting with each other this way, and then...
Well, yeah, but you have to remember, all of these biochemical reactions have a spontaneous rate at which they occur, right? The enzymes are not so much necessary for them to occur at all. They just speed it up. They speed it up tremendously. It could maybe orders of magnitude. So when Bob was saying, well, they needed the enzymes, that's not exactly true. It's just that it would go a lot faster. So life was very slow and inefficient early on, but the reactions can still occur, and they were probably, you know, borrowing chemical energy from lots of stuff that was just in the environment. But when it hit upon something that it can supercharge, you know, all right, here's a reaction we can control, and we can, you know, make enzymes to make it go really fast and basically have energy on demand, then things really took off. But yeah, there was this slow and inefficient phase that they could have plausibly passed through using these alternate energy sources. That's basically what this is saying.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
If you took the molecules that make up ATP and just mixed them into one container together, would they assemble themselves into ATP?
No, because it's a high energy state. You have to put energy into it to get the ATP.
Okay.
Well, Evan, you alluded to the fact that yesterday was also the anniversary of the Mars Phoenix lander touching down, but now NASA is announcing the other end of that journey.
Yeah, almost 2 years to the day, May 24th, NASA came out with their announcement that they have ended the operations concerning the Phoenix Mars lander, in that they, after repeated attempts to contact the spacecraft, they've been unsuccessful, and they have deemed it dead. It died.
Aww.
Well, it wasn't supposed to. Yeah, they didn't really expect it to survive the long, cold Martian winter. It was only designed to.
But it went a lot longer than it was supposed to.
Well, this one went about. They initially collected 90 days worth of data, which is what it was originally designed to do. Plus, they got an extra 60 days out of it. So, 5 months, and that's when the onset of winter came, and it shut down as they expected, and they really didn't expect it to come back to life, but they did go through the process of trying to reestablish contact with it many, many times over the last several months. And new high-resolution photographs of the lander shows that it's suffering from major ice buildup. You know, literally hundreds of pounds of ice have...
Doesn't it look like one of the solar panels broke off?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they can tell that because...
By a Martian.
Yeah, you know, they took pictures. Not quite.
The face on Mars bit off that solar panel.
Or that Bigfoot on Mars went over and went...
Bastard.
Smash.
Mars smash.
They took the photographs of when it was in operational condition. They took, they compared the shadows it was casting from that time to shadows it's casting now, which are much more, you know, smaller and sort of contorted and crushed in on itself. And that's how they were able to help determine for sure that it is no longer at all functioning. This was a important lander that landed on Mars. Phoenix discovered perchlorate, which is a potential indicator of some sort of life existing on Mars. That was probably Phoenix's most important discovery during its mission.
And of course, today was the last day of the last Atlantis mission. Atlantis touched down this morning.
Yep. Beautiful landing. I saw it.
Apparently, it was a perfect landing. And that was the last flight of the shuttle Atlantis.
That really sucks.
Yeah.
Wonder what they're going to do with it.
Why didn't they just let it keep going till we came a lot closer to being able to replace it?
Expense, I guess. Isn't it how expensive that stuff is?
It's expensive to keep it going, and these have a life expectancy. At some point, you decide that the risk of an accident becomes too great, if you try to keep these old systems up and running. And they really can't start retooling for what comes next until they shut this down. But of course, President Obama canceled the Constellation program. It seems like his plan for the future is to let private industry sort of start to take the reins.
I've read that they're attempting to try to keep Atlantis flying for at least maybe another mission or two into 2011.
Really?
And I'm sure that is the efforts of congressmen, senators from Texas, California, Florida.
Yeah. There were a lot of problems with Constellation, and on the other side of the coin is that some people say it was never going to work anyway because it was underfunded. So you either had to massively increase the funding or cut it, right? That it just could, but just going the way we were going was kind of worthless. So some people are glad that we cut it if it frees up NASA to do missions they can actually accomplish. But we're still left without really a solid plan for how we're going to get astronauts to the space station or...
It's solid. We're using the Russians. It's a solid plan. It's just not. I don't think it's a great plan because what if we have some problems? We have some political issues going on there, and they're like, "Sorry, no, you can't go. You can't go to the space station."
Yeah, so much for your 50 billion. Well,
I would not call that a solid problem. You say
no. It's a solid plan. I mean, we got a plan. We're gonna hitch a ride.
Yeah,
that's the plan, and it will work, and it'll work. We'll get up there, but it's just not ideal at all.
It's not going to be the same thing as us having our own shuttle system. We're not going to get the priority on missions. We're not going to have any flexibility whatsoever, right? I mean, how flexible can they be?
There is a difference, and frankly, I think there are some intangible differences and considerations that need to be made. I mean,
it just really sucks that I don't have any faith that we're going to have anything soon that's going to be able to, I'm going to be an old man by the time we have something ready to go next.
On a bright note, SpaceX is planning on launching the Falcon, their first Falcon 9 rocket.
That's cool.
I mean, the Falcon 9 is the first one that this private company, SpaceX, is launching that actually has the capability of getting to the space station. So we'll see if that works out. Hopefully it won't blow up or anything. Well, they've had some problems with earlier rockets.
Yeah.
A couple of quick vaccine updates. Andrew Wakefield, the British physician who really sparked the whole MMR causes autism scare, has been officially struck off the register of physicians in the UK.
Essentially, struck off. That is
struck
awesome.
Off. Yeah, having his license taken away, basically. Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely deserved. But of course, he's just turning this into the martyr thing. He's just playing the martyr card now.
He's making the rounds on all the news here and in the States. It's pretty embarrassing.
But let's hope it's his last hurrah. This should hopefully maybe will be the end of him.
No way. He's plugged into the anti-vaccine movement now. He's going to be their darling for
in
the
fact,
rest of his career.
They're having a rally today, right now, as we record in Chicago. My fellow skeptic Elise has organized a counter protest, and it's been going very well. And they even got some really good press out of it, showing that there is an organized group of people fighting back against the anti-vaccination crowd. And
that's
also, Andrew Wakefield is there, and Elise just sent me a photo of two of her friends posing with Wakefield, smiling and, one of the girls in the picture is wearing a "Hug Me, I'm Vaccinated" necklace.
That is awesome. Oh God, I love
that's
that.
Jamie Bernstein. So good job, Jamie.
Yeah, that's good work. Yeah, Wakefield recently was gloating on his Twitter feed that although the scientific establishment is trying to discredit him, that still one in four parents think that vaccines are linked to autism. He's gloating about that, about
the
misinformation that he spread. Yes.
Now, is that number up or down from recent years?
That seems a little low, actually, 1 in 4. I thought it was more like 30-40%.
Yeah.
But still, it's way too much.
If that's the case, though, I agree with that. It's way too much. However, it could be an indication that opinions is going in the correct direction.
Hopefully. I mean, it's way too easy to spread fear and very difficult to spread correct information. And actually, I'm going to be talking about this in another news item in just a moment. But the other bit of vaccine news I want to just mention quickly, I wrote a very thorough blog article about it on Neurologica, so for the details, you can read that. But basically, there was a recent study which compared the on-time regular vaccine schedule to the alternative schedules, where basically you spread the vaccines out more, you eliminate certain vaccines, so you have fewer vaccines over a longer period of time, the kind of thing that's advocated by
Dr.
Jay Gordon and others, on the slogan, too many, too soon. And it turns out that there was absolutely no difference in any kind of neurological outcomes between the routine schedule and the alternate or delayed schedule. So the whole too many, too soon thing doesn't hold up to at least this one study, which was not unreasonable. It had 1,047 children in it. It was a pretty robust database. It was, of course, observational, not experimental, because you just can't, again, you can't randomize people to getting vaccines or not or delaying them. So you have to just go with what people do. But in any case, at least we could say at this point, there's no evidence to support the too many, too soon slogan of the anti-vaccinationists.
Well, this is good news because I've heard that they're not actually anti-vaccination. They're just pro-safe vaccination. So
yeah.
I'm sure now that they hear that vaccinations are perfectly safe on the current recommended schedule, they'll change their tune and immediately take their kids in to get vaccinated.
Yeah, unlikely.
Yeah, you know, of course.
I'm sorry, did I fall asleep there? Was I in the middle of a dream? I think I was. Sorry about that, guys.
That's their BS propaganda that they're not anti-vaccine. But you know, then when you really nail them on the details, of course, there's nothing that would convince them that vaccines are safe, and they think that they're inherently unsafe. What is it in the vaccines that makes them unsafe? It's the vaccine itself. Well, then it's really just a smokescreen. It's just the part of their marketing savvy, but it's not any truth whatsoever.
But Steve, also though, actually, wasn't there a slight benefit to the kids that got vaccinated early on rather than delayed? It wasn't much, but there was a noticeable difference.
Yeah,
getting it earlier was a little bit better.
Yeah, there's two ways to interpret that. One is that it's just noise in the data, and it's not real. If it is real, it could just be that parents who vaccinate on time are just have a healthier environment in general for their kids.
Or it is a little bit better.
Or it could be that it's protecting them from diseases that could be having an adverse effect. So
that was kind of funny.
This data doesn't really separate those out. We would need other data to figure out where the cause and effect is going. But, yeah, I didn't make too much of that because it was kind of a small effect.
Yeah.
And it's a nice little cherry on top. But the bottom line is even if you just discount that, there was no advantage to delaying the vaccines. That's the bottom line. But this kind of leads nicely into the next news item. There's actually there's a few different studies that caught my attention recently. One specifically to do with the MMR vaccine. But this is all to do with people's attitudes towards science and the kind of things that influence their attitudes towards science. And unfortunately, it's all bad news, especially for skeptics. So one study was looking at the attitudes of parents towards the MMR vaccine and autism, and they separated them out into several different groups and fed them different information and then interviewed them to try to find out how they responded to that information. And without getting into the nitty-gritty details, just give you the bottom line. What they concluded from this was that parents had a significant bias towards believing information that they heard from other parents, that they were more affected. Actually, they were mostly affected by that, by what other parents said. They did not seem to be affected at all by what the scientific evidence said, and they seemed to inherently distrust information that came from the government. So, not a surprise. But that sort of puts it, you know, that's what we're dealing with. People will listen to stories from other people, but not the scientific evidence and not the government as an authority. So when the CDC comes out and says the scientific evidence says that vaccines are safe, people don't buy it. You know, they'll believe the mother who says that, you know, their kid developed problems after getting a vaccine.
Yeah, this certainly fits in with what I used to experience when I used to have a number of friends who were, I guess you could say, alternative. And there was never really a problem with science or the scientific method in and of itself. But there was a huge distrust of the government, and particularly with the pharmaceutical industry's ties to the government. The pharmaceutical industry is the largest lobby in the country. And so most of my friends had a real problem with that, and thinking that it gave them way too much influence. And so therefore you can't trust anything that comes from the government when mm-hmm. it comes to medicine, particularly because of that. So it's unfortunate, but I mean, it,
yeah.
you can, I mean, I can at least see the logic behind it, even though, you know, it's not necessarily true, but you can see how that might, convince people to not trust scientific data.
And there's a kernel of truth to it. You know, if you look at statistically at studies that are funded by pharmaceutical companies, they're more likely to be favorable towards their product than studies that are independently funded.
Right. And I always say that that's one of the big problems with whenever we deal with our defense of anything touching on the pharmaceutical industry, is that the pharmaceutical industry tends to be made up of enormous companies that really do value money, you know,
yeah.
as much as, if not more than, human lives. Like, they do make actual decisions based upon, you know, how much is this going to be worth for us to fix? You know, they make monetary decisions. And yeah, I think we wouldn't always say that they're the right decisions or the moral decisions. So it is tricky to separate, you know, when it's time to sound the alarm about it and yeah. when it's time to trust the science.
Well, I think it's complicated, and taking a simplistic approach like, it's all pharmaceutical companies always lie. They have total control over physicians and universities and the government. That's all simple-minded conspiracy mongering. The actual lines of influence are much more complicated. Now, the pharmaceutical industry, while they are large and they certainly do have a lot of power and influence, they're also highly regulated, and they are very tightly supervised, and especially the research that they do. Also, I don't think that this influence of the funding bias is unique to the pharmaceutical industry. If you could look at pretty much anything, if you look at acupuncture studies, they're much more likely to be positive if they're performed in Asian countries where belief in acupuncture is high than if you compare them to North American or European studies. So, I mean, any way you try to look at it, you know, the biases of the researchers, there's a certain influence there, but it's not overwhelming, and it doesn't invalidate the science itself. It just means we need more of a consensus. We got to believe more rigorous studies. We got to look carefully at how things are being done. We definitely have to look closely at conflicts of interest. Although then again, that could easily become a witch hunt that is used to dismiss inconvenient data. So unfortunately, it's not a simple world where we could say just trust the science. It is a complicated world where you have to really parse, you know, a lot of influences. But at the end of the day, we can have a set of reliable consensus data upon which to base conclusions. And that's the bottom line difference, I think, between, say, scientific skeptics who would look critically but ultimately, you know, trusting the process of science, versus those who have just given in to the most extreme conspiracy theory and don't trust it at all.
To get back to the original story, I think two important takeaways is that if you want to convince people of a scientific consensus, you know, don't throw scientists in their face. You know, throw the contemporaries, their colleagues, you know, people that are similar to them, other parents in this case. You know, make them a prominent part of that kind of advertising if you really want to convince
right.
them. You know, the other side of the coin from that study is to work on convincing people that, you know, how we could better communicate to them. To convince them that you know that there are some things that we can be so confident about that it's kind of silly
right.
not to believe what they're saying about it.
So Bob, you're saying that we should popularize it.
Well, it's, you know, it's the framing
thing.
Extent, it's,
yeah.
You know, popularizing. I do think that if we raising the general level of scientific literacy will help. You know,
absolutely.
The framing thing I think is a double-edged sword because as soon as you start to get a little marketing savvy with a scientific message, then people start to wonder why you're being so marketing savvy.
Right.
You know,
right.
It just kind of it can easily backfire. It's tough. It's almost a no-win situation in some ways. I think the only real solution is just raising the level of scientific literacy and also, you know, working on the regulations. Sometimes you just can't get public opinion, you know, in the right place, and you just need to have rational regulations that are evidence-based. Let me tell you about two other studies that bear upon this, also recently published.
There's more?
Yeah, there's two other studies really quickly, but they're all very, very related. There's an ESP study where they told individuals, again, in different groups, that, for example, 25% of the public believes in ESP, but the scientific community rejects the concept, or 90% of the public believes in ESP, but the scientific community considers it bogus. Or they basically varied those two variables, where 25% believe in it, but the scientific community is becoming more open to the idea, or 90% believe in it, and scientists are coming around to it. So basically, they varied those two variables, popular appeal and scientific belief. It turns out that people were much more likely to accept ESP based upon whether it was they were told that it was popular.
Absolutely.
And when they were told that science rejects it versus accepts it, they were more likely to accept ESP if they were told scientists reject it. So they went against the scientific consensus on ESP. Uh-oh. It actually had the opposite effect.
Yeah, that coincides with lots of research we've heard in the past, even.
Yeah.
One bit of research I came across most recently was how to persuade kids, teenagers, you know, not to smoke, not to do drugs, not to do whatever they shouldn't be doing.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to convince them, have their colleagues talking about it. That's, you know, not the colleagues, have their contemporaries, have their friends and people of their own age group. If you want to sway them, that's how you're going to do it.
Yeah, yep. That's called social norming. Rather than using scare tactics, the scared straight approach, you say, your friends are not doing this. And just basically use peer pressure, not rational.
Remember Scared Straight? I remember Scared Straight like 20 or 30 years ago where they
had these failure.
Yeah, the prison inmates basically taking a bunch of these troublesome kids and just trying to scare the hell out of them about what's going to happen to them if they stay on this path. And I remember watching that stuff years ago and thinking, yeah, that's a good idea. Scare the crap out of them. Let them know what it's really going to be like to be in if they ever go to prison and go through all that trouble. And it didn't, and they did follow-ups years later. It did not work. Did not work.
So it's funny because our inherent assumption is that you convince people with rational arguments. But all the data shows that most people are not influenced by rational arguments. They're influenced by social pressure.
Isn't that awesome?
That's just the human condition, and we just have to just acknowledge it and accept it. The final study, very quickly, also very disheartening. This is a bad triad of studies where they, again, interviewed people, gave them information, and then to see how it affected them. The bottom line here was that if people were presented with scientific evidence which disconfirms something which they already believe, their response to that generally is to conclude that science itself is untrustworthy. Not just the science that they're being presented, but the scientific method in general. And that therefore confronting people with tightly held beliefs with the scientific evidence, not only does it not work, it turns them off to science in general, even about unrelated topics. It has a huge negative influence. So
anyway, this is our last episode of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Damn.
We couldn't think of an easy way to tell you all.
There's a lot of psychological studies which, you know, like the whole thing about if you tell somebody that here's a myth and the myth is wrong, 3 weeks later, some significant percentage of them remember the myth as being correct.
Oh, gosh.
Right? So there's all kinds of cautionary data, and we have to be very careful about how we go about doing things. Otherwise, if we just, you know, beat our heads against the human emotions and psychology and belief, we're actually likely to drive people in the wrong direction.
That's it. I'm done. I'm shipping off to the planet Vulcan. I'll see you guys later.
The one around the sun? That must drive the Mythbusters insane.
My response to that is probably similar to a lot of other people's, where I'm like, but science is so cool. Right. So how can you like just throw it all away? One stupid thing comes out, or something that you don't agree with comes out, but there's still so much other so many other things, so much other stuff to see and to learn and to look at. I just don't get how people's minds aren't enraptured by this like mine is.
Their science isn't really a significant part of their lives at all.
That's why we have to get them young.
Right. Science
brainwash them.
Boring, dry facts. And they don't think about it. They just don't think about it. So,
right. Oh, man.
When you're starting from there, it's not surprising at all. But Rebecca, you're absolutely right. Get them young. That's it.
All right. Well, let's keep hitting our head against the wall. Who's going to talk about the acupuncturist
who
got
God.
Some rapists out of prison?
I'll talk about it. I'll talk about how much I hate life right now. Why are you doing this to me? Why is this the most depressing? This is the most depressing show ever right now.
It is. We got to spice it up. I could spice it up right now if you guys want.
Well, go ahead, Joe.
I could flip it around and make people smile.
Go ahead.
It's up to you.
Give it a shot.
All right, go on. All
right, I'll do it.
Just
all right.
Do it.
Real quick, this is my Who's That Noisy of the Week. Ready? What is that?
Sylvia Brown.
Sylvia
Brown on a good day.
Oh, that does put a smile on your face.
I guess we'll find out next week.
Good luck.
Jay's special Who's That Noisy.
Yeah. Speaking of none of that, three convicted rapists just were let out of jail because an acupuncturist says they're all virgins.
What?
Ta-da!
No.
Oh,
you're
fantastic.
Where'd you get that? The Onion?
I wish.
Oh, my God.
It's coming from Times Live. This is at timeslive.co.za. I'm not sure what ZA stands for, actually. What is that? Zimbabwe?
Zoolander?
Zanzibar?
Sasquatch.
So three men in Vietnam were convicted in 2002 of raping an 18-year-old woman. And so they were sentenced to 11 to 16 years in jail. And then an acupuncturist examined them. And
ZA is South Africa. Go ahead.
South Africa. Okay. An acupuncturist examined them, and particularly a pressure point beneath their ears, which showed a small capillary that was unbroken, which, according to made-up fairy tales, says that they've never had sex with a woman.
With a woman.
With a woman. Maybe
right.
Having sex with a man or... And I don't know, maybe it's just human women. Maybe if you've had sex with a dog or something.
I noticed that.
They determined
I noticed they specifically mentioned woman because these guys have been in prison for 11 years.
Yeah, who knows? So,
needles
yes,
never lie.
Apparently the testimony of this acupuncturist was enough to let all three of these men out of prison. To make matters even worse, this is now getting press. And so the acupuncturist is being contacted by others who feel that she may be able to help them be proven innocent. So it looks like she'll be making a nice career out of letting rapists and other criminals out of jail thanks to her pseudoscience.
Wow, she could see a small capillary under the skin. That's amazing, considering that they're microscopic.
Yep.
Details.
Capillary.
So if she could tell that small capillary didn't break a decade ago.
Well, it's never broken.
Because, you know, when you break a small capillary, it never repairs itself.
It's like a hymen. It's like a hymen, but microscopic in your ear.
Yeah, it sits there broken, and then you can detect it on exam 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the level of nonsense in pseudoscience is staggering. Staggering.
That can't be right. Oh my God.
No, it's very depressing.
It's a national embarrassment for Vietnam, basically.
So is anything going to be done about this?
Yes, we're going to mock and ridicule them.
Can you imagine these guys? You know they're getting drunk right now saying in Vietnamese, "How lucky are we?"
Right?
Can you believe
these
guys?
I can't believe they bought it.
Check her out.
It's awful.
Well, let's go on to the real Who's That Noisy. Evan, can you play Who's That Noisy from last week?
There is a real Who's That Noisy. I almost forgot. But all right, here we go. Last week's Who's That Noisy.
But I've been running scared about a heart attack since I'm 30, maybe 20, which is what drove me into the jungles of the South Seas collecting plants, drove me to get a PhD in epidemiology and nutrition, drove me to research and write books on health before I went into radio.
That was the voice of Michael Savage, a syndicated radio talk show host here in the United States. For those of you who are familiar with Dr. Savage, he holds a master's degree in medical botany and medical anthropology, and he earned his PhD from University of California, Berkeley in nutritional ethnomedicine. Ooh. He's written books on herbal medicine and, of course, homeopathy. He's an interesting fellow in that he's a proponent of homeopathy, yes, but at the same time, he's not entirely anti-pharmaceutical company. He's not a big pharma conspiracy sort of person. He is on select things. At least he recognizes that medicine is certainly useful, practical in a lot of instances. He doesn't feel in all instances, you know, over-prescribing drugs for kids, for instance, is one of his pet peeves. So he's not one of these raging anti-pharma homeopaths, but a homeopath nonetheless. And yeah, he's not ashamed of it either.
Well, why would he be?
He's not ashamed of anything else.
What do you got for this week?
For this week, we have another person that you need to identify. So tell me, who's that noisy?
Tear gas attack? Because when you cut into an onion, cells rupture, releasing enzymes which break down nearby sulfur compounds into oxides and acids.
Someone talking about the chemistry
of onions.
Of onions. Listen to it a couple times, and I think some people will get this correct. But be the first one. Good luck, everyone.
Joining us now is James Randi. Randi, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Good to be here.
And unfortunately, we're having you on again so soon because of a sad occasion. This past week, Martin Gardner passed away, and he was a close friend of yours. So none of us knew him personally, although, of course, we knew him through his many books, his column in the Skeptical Inquirer, going back a ways, his column, mathematics column in the Scientific American. But you, of course, had a personal relationship with him. Can you tell us about your relationship with Martin Gardner?
Well, I've been asked the inevitable question, when did you first meet Martin Gardner?
Right.
It seems to me that I've always known him. I don't remember a time when I didn't know him. It was a good 60 years ago, and I suspect that I was, I believe I recall that I was in the offices of Scientific American magazine in New York City, and Jerry Peel was the editor at that time, and somehow he introduced me to Martin. I guess maybe Martin dropped into the office in some way. I don't quite recall, but again, it seems like I've always known him, and it seems like I still do. It's astonishing that a part of my life that important is no longer with me.
So you met him when you were in your 20s?
Yep, mm-hmm. And that would be when I first came to New York City. And we spent such a long time together, off and on, back and forth, trips to Europe and around the world and everything. And I always came back, and Martin was always there.
So to what degree did – I mean, obviously he was a very prolific writer and was not afraid to take on pseudoscience. But to what degree was he involved with your paranormal investigations or that activity that you engaged in?
I remember one famous event was when Psykov, now CFI, and I, and Paul Kurtz was there, investigated Susie Cottrell. That's a magical name in psychic circles, or it used to be. She was a girl who had learned how to do a very basic card trick from her father, I'm sure, because he was a habitué of Las Vegas and lost a lot of money there, but he had lots of it, so he didn't care. And she had learned how to do this particular trick. It was sort of a classic among card magicians, and not one of those things that worked every time, but it worked often enough that she could fool people with it. She fooled Johnny Carson with it.
Mm-hmm.
it was rather odd because John knew card magic very well, and it really fooled the heck out of him. It was a very simple trick. I won't go into the description of the thing, but she was able to force a card on a person. That is, when she spread a face-down deck on the table with a gentleman who would sit opposite her and just ask him to reach out and slide out four or five cards towards himself face down, and then she would have him choose one of those cards, and she would have named it in advance. It was a hell of a good trick, and she had learned it very well. Martin, a clever guy, I'll tell you. He knew all the gimmicks that, well, most of the gimmicks, I'm sure, that card sharpers use. And when Susie Cottrell was tested by us, I've forgotten exactly where it was. I think it might have been in Buffalo. We sat her down. First of all, we had a video camera on a tripod that stood up above the table, and there was a designated area on the table that was chalked off there as the area that the camera was taking. What she didn't know was that that wasn't the camera that was working. There was another camera sitting there surreptitiously, and it was doing the actual taping. That was a dummy that was sitting up there. She did not know that, and we taped her, and we entrapped her completely. It was very obvious what she had been doing. But Martin was bold enough, and he was not a very bold man when it came to things like this. He was very shy about things. When Susie left the room, she left behind her makeup case. Martin just lifted the lid on a little box there, and it was full of eyeshadow of all different colors. It dawned on Martin that maybe she was using what the gamblers call daub, D-A-U-B. What you do is you just touch a bit of this makeup of the same color as the cards that you were using, the backs of the cards, that is. And if you want to mark a certain card, all you have to do is, as you reach out towards it, is to tap the back of it with that marked finger, and it leaves a little bit of the makeup, which doesn't show prominently, but it does show if you know exactly where to look on the back of the card. And then you shuffle the cards together, and when they're all spread out on the table, you can pick out that particular card rather easily because you're looking for it, and they can't see that because they don't notice it, and it wipes off very easily. So Martin suspected that, and what we did was we simply fastened the lid on her makeup case down so tightly that she couldn't get into it, and she was quite frustrated. It turned out that she could do the trick without using the daub technique. It wasn't really essential to the trick, but it would be a very good way of doing it. So Martin was in on that, and we got the videotape, and as I say, it was very effective. That's the kind of thing that Martin helped me with. Of course, Martin was much more helpful than that. He was everywhere. Everywhere that I went, I seemed to run into him. We had so many long, long talks and visits at his home. At the romantic place that he lived in Croton-on-Hudson was 10 Euclid Avenue. Isn't that romantic? Wow. And we always accused him of having the building renumbered or renamed and such to honor him, but that wasn't so, though he said that it did have a certain attraction for him.
So was he really an inspiration for you when you were younger?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, very much. He encouraged me a great deal just by his presence and by his very free advice that he always gave to me. He went out of his way to make sure that I had stories and accounts and whatnot correct. He tried to preserve me from being a blatant liar. And that worked more or less well, not perfectly, but well. Mm-hmm. He was an inspiration. I can't describe to you how significant he was in my life.
You know, I've read a number of years ago his book, Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science. I think it's probably a good time to reread it. But one thing I do remember from it is the book was first published in 1952, but it's amazing how relevant it still is today.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I don't know that was due to his artistry as an author, because he had wonderful control of prose and everything. His books were always well stated and very carefully stated. But in Fads and Fallacies, we are going to purchase to give away in large numbers at the next amazing meeting. And incidentally, that's another thing, too. I would urge everyone out there who remembers Martin favorably and wishes to commemorate him, he would be hugely embarrassed if he thought that people were feeling sad about his passing. It's been suggested that we do a memoriam of him at the next amazing meeting, which is coming up in July. But we're not going to do that. We're going to do a celebration of his existence, and I'd like to have balloons and dancing girls. The fact that he was among us for 95 years. And I can tell you, folks, when I would call Martin, it was always Martin Gardner here right away. And then as soon as he heard my voice, oh, yes, he suddenly cheered up a great deal because he got a lot of cuckoo calls, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
That out. But he was always alert and fast, sense of humor. He didn't lose. His son Jim just told me the other day, he said that Martin didn't lose a bit of his wit, even when he had the stroke that led very, very quickly to his death. He was making jokes of it, that people shouldn't make such a fuss. He said, go and make a fuss over a younger person.
Yeah, it's amazing. Some people just stay sharp even into their 80s, 90s, even over 100. You know, obviously there's very few people who live that long, but some people seem just not to develop the typical degeneration or signs of aging in their brain. And I guess just lucky with the genetic, you know, lottery there. And it sounds like from what you're saying, he was really sharp right up until the end.
Oh yes. Now I'll give you an example. He used to always complain about his memory. He said, oh, at my age, I can't remember that. I asked him one time, and these are not the original names, but I said one time on a phone call, a year or so ago, I said, Martin, there was a fellow named Spencer that you referred to me once. His name was it Wilfred Spencer? And he said, oh, I don't I just can't remember names like that, Randy. At my age, it's very difficult. No, that would be Winfred. Winfred. No, yes, it was Winfred. I remember. Yes, he said that was so long ago that it would. I can't remember it. That would be 1938 or so. And I remember it was late in the year. It had to be in November. There was snow on the ground. I remember that distinctly. We had a hard time moving around. It was in New York City, yeah. That would be late in the year, in November in 1938, and I'd say to him, Martin, you just told me that your memory is failing. And he says, yeah, I had a hard time coming up with that.
Yeah.
A bear trap of the brain, I can assure you. There were no things that he forgot completely. They would just slip his mind temporarily. I forget what I had for breakfast. In fact, I don't remember if I had breakfast this morning. But Martin would know. Martin would know.
Do you have a particularly fond memory of some experience that you shared with him?
Oh, my. There are so many. There are so many. He was not afraid of flying, but his wife, Charlotte, was very much afraid of flying. And they drove a rattletrap old Cadillac and around that was that rattled, as Martin used to say, more than I rattle. They had a wonderful thing of on weekends during good weather. They would take off on Friday night, and they would go to some small town that had a good used bookstore, for example, which Martin just delighted in visiting. And he told me about one time he and Charlotte went. She would go off to antique stores, and one day she showed up in the bookstore and picked him up, and he was just going for the desk, and he said, Charlotte, look what I found in the used bookstore. Look, and he showed her a copy of a book, a very old book. And he said, you know, this is a copy of a book. I lost my copy many, many years ago. My father gave me this book when I was just a child. I was only about 10 years of age. He gave me this book. And this is a book that first interested me in science and in mathematics. And it's a very good book. It's by Sam Jones. And that was the actual name, yes. He said, yes, I read this book as a child. And she said, oh, you're going to buy it then? He says, oh, yes, of course. And he walked over to the desk, laid down the book. He opened the back of the book to look at the price. Oh, my. It was the same book.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same book that his father had given him as a child because his notes were in the back cover. And it's a hard story to tell because he told me that with great passion. He said, can you imagine what the chances of this are, Randy? Against chance alone, that it's incredible. And I was startled and I looked at the book dealer and I said, oh my, this used to be my book. And then he he showed the dedication that his father had written to my beloved son, Martin. And
yeah,
wow.
That episode stays with me and always will stay with me. And the bookseller just looked at it, and he folded the cover and he put it in a bag and he said, "No, that's yours." And Martin never had to pay for it.
Wow, that's a great story.
Wow.
Can you imagine the chances? Again, mathematically, of course, he would be thinking of it mathematically, wouldn't he? You know, he never took any mathematics after high school, by the way. He never took another course in mathematics after high school. He just learned it as he went along. He found out that in Scientific American, when he started to do the column, that it was very popular and for students of mathematics and readers of Scientific American in general. And the Scientific American column was the one reason, the fact that his column was in there, was the one reason that readers gave during a poll many years ago that they bought or subscribed to Scientific American. They wanted that above anything else that appeared in Scientific American.
Yeah. Yeah, those little nuggets are really what people go for.
Rightly so.
But probably his two most famous books in skeptical circles are Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science, and then in 1981 he wrote Science, Good, Bad, and Bogus. Is mm-hmm. there anything that he did in the skeptical or scientific realm that skeptics would find surprising or probably not aware of that you think should have a higher profile?
Well, he was. It's important to know that he was a fideist. He did believe in the existence of a deity, and he told me, now that sounds very strange that he would have that kind of belief. He knew that I was a dyed-in-the-wool atheist, and I don't say that God doesn't exist. I merely say I don't see sufficient evidence to believe there is a God. So I'm an atheist of the second kind, as I've often specified. I don't deny the existence of a God because I can't prove it. However, he was a fideist, and when I discussed this with him, somewhat in shock, many, many years ago. He said, well, he said, I will admit one thing. Atheists have a far, far better argument than I have. I have no evidence whatsoever to support my belief, but it makes me feel much more comfortable. And from Martin, that's all that I needed to know. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to go into reasoning with him or arguing with him. I would never do that with Martin. Oh, my. No, I would eventually lose, I'm sure. And I didn't want that to happen. How disgraceful. But, he was a deist, if you will. And he just said that he didn't quite see enough reason to assume that everything happened without a guiding hand of some kind. But he said that he prayed from time to time. And he said, because if there is a God, it certainly can't hurt at all. Now, he wasn't that was Pascal's wager.
Yeah.
He didn't share that feeling with Pascal, that if he didn't do it, he was risking a great deal. No, not at all. I don't think he could possibly have thought that way. But he did say, hey, it can't hurt. And he said, it gives me a chance to state my feelings and my needs and my wishes. So I do it very quietly, and I don't burden anyone else with it. But from Martin, I could accept that because he was a logical soul, and I don't find a problem with it. I just have never been offended by that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've always used Martin Gardner as the example of a rational, logical deist. You know, when people try to say that, well, nobody just believes in God. They all try to make a scientific or logical argument for God. I'm like, well, that's not true. As far as I know, Martin Gardner's a naked deist. He doesn't really use any attempt to try to justify his belief with any kind of, you know, logical argument with any kind of or any pretense of evidence. It's just a personal choice. And what you're saying confirms what I'd always read about that.
Yep, it's very true. And of course, I will always respect his memory, certainly, and I hope that all of our listeners will, and that they will get out, and if they haven't got a copy of Fads and Fallacies, at least that book is something you should buy. Oh, by the way, I guess I should mention, as a matter of considerable pride, he dedicated his latest book to me, and that, I mean, Martin Gardner dedicating a book to me? Damn, that's something else, isn't it?
Yeah.
I am doing, maybe an interesting story. Linking Ring, The Linking Ring is the name of one of the more popular magic journals, the International Brotherhood of Magicians. They have commissioned me to do a sizable article on Martin Gardner, because one thing that the press releases have only mentioned or only suggested is that he was a contributor to the art of magic, and he was in so many ways. I still do a couple of little Martin Gardner tricks even today. He liked things that were simple, done with matchsticks or with coins or something like that. No big illusions or fireballs or anything like that for him. He moderate in his requirements of a magic trick being a good trick. He thought that simplicity would the soul of the whole thing. And I believe that it is. There's no question.
Well, he has certainly left behind quite a legacy that we all appreciate. And Randy, we greatly appreciate you sharing your memories with us.
Well, I loved him. I still do. And I hope that other people will share that affection for him.
Thanks, Randy.
Thank you, sir.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is fictitious. Everyone ready for this week?
Mm-hmm. Word.
Okay, here we go. Item number one. Doctors recently diagnosed a man as having the first ever brain infection with a computer virus. Item number two, scientists have built the world's smallest electronic device, a transistor consisting of only 7 atoms. And item number three, new studies find that having allergies significantly reduces the risk of acquiring certain cancers. Evan, go first.
In order, doctors recently diagnosed a man as having the first ever brain infection with a computer virus. How is that possible? I think that's so implausible that has to be true. I'll move on to the next one. Scientists have built the world's smallest electronic device, the transistor consisting of only 7 atoms. That's interesting and fascinating at the same time. I'm inclined to say that one's true. The last one was new studies find that having allergies significantly reduces the risk of acquiring certain cancers. Wow. I think they're all true. I think number 4 is the fiction. But I suppose that's just an indication that these are good ones, that I cannot figure this out for the life of me. How do you have, again, I'm going back to the first one, the brain infection with a computer virus. I don't see the connection there. I'm missing something. I think I have a blind spot here. Maybe it's something obvious, but I really am having a hard time connecting that one. Again, which my instinct is to say that that one's fiction. All right, well, I'll go with the allergies one is fiction, for no other reason than I'm just stabbing wildly in the dark.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, so the doctors recently diagnosed a man as having the first ever brain infection with a computer virus. When you say, I need you to define the word infection as it's used here.
Wouldn't really be fair since Evan's already gone.
Oh, that's bullshit, Steve, really? All right, number one's the fake.
Okay, Rebecca?
I do think that allergies can reduce the risk of acquiring certain cancers. And I think for, depending on the way you define, I mean, you can define electronic device in fairly liberal terms. So I can see scientists being able to make one out of 7 atoms. But in order to get a computer virus in your brain, you would first need to have a bit of computer in your brain, and then you would need to connect that to the internet somehow, and it would preferably be running Windows without Norton on it, and then you would have to be like, oh, what's this .exe from someone I've never heard of? And then I'll just open it with my brain, and then you've got a virus in your brain. And frankly, that's just stupid. It could happen in the future, and it could happen in other ways, but no.
Okay.
That's fake.
Bob?
Yeah, generally good analysis, guys. I think
most
of you pretty much nailed it. Not you, Evan, no. Yeah, the allergies, reducing the risk of acquiring certain cancers. There's so many different types of cancers. I have no problem with an algae actually impacting your risk for some of them. It's not incredibly extraordinary. Electronic device, electronic device is vague, but transistor isn't. But seven atoms, yeah, we're heading there, and I thought we actually got even better than that. But yeah, I've got no problem with that at all. And the first one, yeah, the first one's just give me a break. You're only going to get an infection from a computer virus if it's, you know, a device that's implanted in your body is hacked, which is very possible. I read an article recently about cars getting hacked, and it's just eventually lots of people are going to have lots of devices implanted in their body that could be hacked. That's going to happen, and if it hasn't already, if Steve's basing this on a real story. But a brain infection with a computer virus, I don't think we're at the point where we're really implanting these computer devices in brains of people. You've got the cochlear implants. Would you classify that as a brain implant? I don't know. But a lot of those devices are implanted in like the arm and finger or whatever, not the brain, not yet. And you wouldn't call it a brain infection anyway. I guess, is it possible that you could implant a computer device in your brain that is infected with a virus, and then that virus causes it to malfunction in some way that actually – now, still, there's no virus, there's no bacteria. I really can't see it. So that one is fiction.
Okay. So you all agree that number two is science, that scientists have built the world's smallest electronic device, a transistor consisting of only seven atoms, and that one is science. Yeah, not much of a surprise there. Yeah. This is a quantum dot.
They're cool.
Yeah, it's a transistor made up of only seven atoms.
Is this smaller than like nanomachines?
Yeah, this is 4 billionths of a meter long, and they were able to place each atom specifically in order to make the device. So that's also.
So they probably use like a scanning tunneling microscope or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. So they use that not only to observe and manipulate the atoms, but purposely put them where they want them to be.
So mass production is going to be a problem using that technique. You can't be building them atom by atom manually. So they've got to somehow.
They've got to automate it somehow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go back to item number one. Let me read you the headline of this particular news item. First human infected with computer virus. Guys, any of you guys seen this article?
Yeah, not in his brain.
Yeah, probably not in his brain.
No, it wasn't his brain. That's why it's fiction. So he had – this is deliberate. He had a computer chip inserted into his hand, and he deliberately infected it with a computer virus and demonstrated that that virus can be passed on to other devices. And done by Dr. Gasson, and it was sort of proof of principle of what you were talking about, Bob, that as we get more and more computer-driven devices – inserted into us, that there is the very real risk that they can acquire and pass on viruses, that they could be hacked, and that would be a problem. If somebody could hack into your pacemaker, that's quite a vulnerability.
Yeah, that just seems kind of
obvious, it's almost ridiculous.
Yeah, I didn't know how you guys were going to try to make sense of that one. But I couldn't use it as a real one, even though the headline is sensational, because it's not really being infected with the computer virus. And I couldn't, it just wouldn't be
right,
fair.
Right, right.
So anyway, sometimes the obvious one is the actual fiction. Gotta do that.
Yes.
You have to do that sometimes. So still, I thought, that headline caught my attention. You know, infected with the computer virus.
You fooled Evan.
I did. He was flummoxed.
I wasn't. Excuse me. I was not flummoxed.
You were befuddled.
I said
he was baffled.
He
was baffled.
I answered that one first, and I said I had no idea how those two things could possibly connect.
That's right.
I think
you were right. You were right,
but
you were so befuddled that you gave the wrong answer.
I think Rebecca and I just pulled this one off.
I was impressed with the other two.
Right, Rebecca, it wasn't hard.
You and me, Jay, high five.
Well, let's go on to number three.
Screw you guys.
New studies find that having allergies significantly reduces the risk of acquiring certain cancers. That one, of course, is science. Very interesting. This is a correlational study. Obviously, so it's hard to prove cause and effect, but the hypothesis is that people with allergies have a lower incidence of lymphoma and of ovarian cancer. Now, the hypothesis is that the allergies stimulate the immune system. The immune system is more active, and that means that they'll be more active in other ways as well, such as, you know, killing off cancer cells before they could form into a tumor or a cancer. Still needs a lot of research, but it's a very interesting hypothesis. I think it also, Tim, in my mind, what this indicates, something that I think we generally understand, is that things like the immune system exist in a certain equilibrium where there's a trade-off. You know, the immune system could become more robust, but as it does so, you get both positive and negative effects. You get, maybe it's better at fighting off cancer, but you got allergies, right? If you dial the immune system down, you may not suffer from the negative consequences of immune activity, but you may be more susceptible to infections and cancers. Of course, we run into this therapeutically in medicine. If somebody has an autoimmune disease and we treat that with immunosuppressants, we suppress the disease, but we also suppress their immune system, and they get a higher incidence of infections. So it's in a balance. But that also indicates, of course, that simplistic notions about quote-unquote boosting the immune system are nonsense. There is no essentially risk-free way to quote-unquote boost the immune system.
I would say other than getting a good night's sleep and eating healthy, there's nothing else you could do.
Yeah, so I mean you can avoid things that will inhibit the immune system, like being run down, being malnourished,
stress,
being under a lot of stress, absolutely. And stress not only just saps your body of resources, but it actually releases corticosteroids, which directly inhibit the immune system. So there's actually a biochemical mechanism there. But anyway, so I thought it was very interesting for that reason. It sort of indicates a sort of trade-off that biological systems have, and that we can't simple-mindedly push and pull on different aspects of biological function without considering, how it works, in with the whole system and what the balance and the trade-off is.
Which I wonder if that points to the way of augmenting ourselves in the future by not. Maybe it's better that we don't try to tweak, like you said, our immune system or other aspects of our biology, but kind of try to deal with these issues in an external way that's outside of biology almost, by just confronting these issues head on with things like nanomachines in the blood that will just wipe out these problems without messing with our, the delicate balance of our.
Yeah, but even then, Bob, let's say you do that. You invent some nanites that can scavenge and hunt for bacteria and viruses. But maybe they would deprive the immune system of regular stimulation, and the immune system will become less effective, and that may have unintended consequences as well. So even then, I don't think that's risk-free, which is why the bottom line is, whenever you do anything which manipulates the immune system, you have to do very careful clinical studies to see what is the net effect. And we've had very mixed results trying to predict what the effect will be when we develop new drugs that manipulate the immune system. I always remember, I believe it was alpha interferon was developed to treat MS, and in fact, it made it worse. So we thought, based upon our current understanding of how the immune system works, that this specific immune modulator would decrease activity of MS, and in fact it made it worse. But then beta interferon worked. It did actually improve clinical outcomes. So we're still at the point where we know a lot about the immune system. It's ridiculously complex, but we still need to do net studies to really see what the effect things are. You can't just extrapolate from the basic science.
Yeah, but also back to my point, Steve. I understand what you're saying. But also, don't forget, I mean, I'm not necessarily advocating, sending these things into your system and wiping, wipe out all bacteria, kill, that kind of thing. It's more of, when troubles arise, and it'd be a great way to handle it.
Oh, yeah, short term, like when you're during an infection, yeah.
Right, things like that, and not necessarily, having system-wide, confrontations in your body with these things until we really figure things out to such a degree, orders of magnitude better than we have now.
Right. And then even then you worry that, well, maybe they'll kill off too much of the good bacteria. And then...
Just back up your brain.
What does that have to do with anything?
Worst case scenario, we really screwed up. Just reload, reboot.
The ultimate solution.
You get a virus.
And, don't even start that shit, dude. We're not starting the continuity discussion right now. So.
No, right. You're right, Jay.
Jay, you got a quote for us?
I got a quote. Biographical history, as taught in our public schools, is still largely a history of boneheads. Ridiculous kings and queens, paranoid political leaders, compulsive voyagers, ignorant generals, the flotsam and jetsam of historical currents. The men who radically altered history, the great scientists and mathematicians, are seldom mentioned, if at all. Martin Gardner!
Oh, yeah.
Of course. Great. That's a good quote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting because that reminds me of, you know, other comments that I've heard that, like, the way history is taught most commonly in school is only telling history from a very particular and narrow perspective. There are lots of other ways to tell the story of history. And one of those, of course, is the history of scientific advancement and understanding.
Yeah.
And that's just as relevant, just as important, just as much our history as the history of kings and queens and wars, right?
And more fascinating, some might say.
Yeah.
I mean, just watch Connections.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Carl Sagan talks about it in Demon Haunted World in his chapter Anti-Science, I believe, which I'm rereading again. So I suggest you go back, read that chapter, and he makes that exact point.
Well, the fact of the matter is that you could even throw heavy interpretation on events that you would think would be based on fact.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the way from a person's perspective, if two people watch the same battle and even though the same side would win, they both could represent it in such a different degree. And I don't know, that might not be completely to the point of this particular quote, but the reason why I picked this quote was I just thought I was going through a lot of his quotes, and this one, even though it wasn't really focused on math or something that he was really involved in, I thought it was a really, really insightful idea.
No, it shows that he didn't just have like one narrow specialty. He was a very deep thinker in a wide range of areas.
Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
In November of this year, we're going to Australia.
That's what I hear.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
And I'm very excited. You're excited, right?
It should be fun. Should be a lot of fun.
It should be fun. But we need help.
That's true. It's going to be ridiculously expensive for us to go to all
fly
down to Australia.
We need a plane or a boat. Yes, or a boat. Not a boat. We'll fly.
I mean, the bottom line is we're really planning the trip right now. We're making final decisions, and we're seeing how incredibly expensive this whole endeavor is. So just asking, please go to our homepage. We have a button on there where you can donate and help us swing this. The more that people donate, the easier it's going to be for us to get there. And
the more we can do when we get there.
Yeah.
So, again, just to be clear, because I don't want to give the wrong impression, we're 100% absolutely going, but this will help us, and it'll also help us make the most of it when we get there. Absolutely.
Yeah, and also, anybody that has any good ideas of things that we could do in Australia, in Sydney, we're asking questions now, like, what should we be doing when we're there? What other events are there that are going on that we might want to attend? So anybody that has any idea about any of this stuff, we would really appreciate it.
Preferably people from Australia.
Oh, preferably.
Well, thanks for joining me again, everyone, this week.
Thank you,
Steve.
I
had nothing better to do.
Yep. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. So, Randi, I guess we'll be seeing you at the Amazing Meeting in a couple months. We're really looking forward to it.
Oh, yes, indeed. And indeed, I'm off to Europe on the 7th of June. So I've got a lot of touring to do there, and that'll be a test of whether or not I'm still alive.
I'm sure you're going to have an awesome time.
Oh, yeah, I will. And they've set up some wonderful stuff for me. I'm going to have a complete tour of the city of Copenhagen to trace out the footsteps of my paternal grandfather. Gramps is going to relive somewhat in that fact. And they've looked up a lot of wonderful things on my family history there, too, that are probably a surprise. And I may be descended from cattle thieves, for all I know. I'm not sure.